This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. And by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Even the most hardcore political junkies ought to be glad for the break. There aren't any primaries or caucuses until Saturday. Meanwhile, the politicians are out raising more money. Analysts are still trying to figure out exactly what last night means. And media companies are looking for more ears and eyeballs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. And by Siemens, from strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, February 6th. Great to have you here. The Pacific time zone worked to Californians' political advantage last night. We were able to get all the late returns and still be in bed by 10 or so. For those who did stay up until the wee small hours, more of you tuned into cable news than have in the past. And although you couldn't tell just by last night, politics is going to boost the long-term economic fortunes of the Internet. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson reports.
Here's where one interested voter in Washington, D.C. got her election news.
We watched CNN last night, and I've been browsing the net this morning.
Carol Doherty of the Pew Research Center says that's pretty typical this year. The number of Americans getting campaign news from the web is triple what it was in 2000. But people still prefer TV on election night. Pew conducted a poll on who followed Iowa caucus returns as they came in last month. Nearly a third of respondents said they did.
The overwhelming majority of those people, 26% overall, said they followed returns on television. Just 3% said they followed it on the web.
But don't let that fool you. Overall, campaign coverage is helping websites grow. The Drudge Report claims 30 million hits in the last 24 hours. And Jim Vandehei, co-founder of the startup Politico, says more than 4 million visitors logged on last month. That's still not enough ad revenue to cover costs.
I don't think we'll be profitable this year. I hope we're profitable next year, which for a startup company that has 80 employees, I think that's pretty good.
Vandehei says building the brand by getting Politico reporters on TV and radio has been key to bringing in advertisers. But TV needs the net, too. Chris Ahrens of MediaBistro.com says just look at ABC last night with the Facebook logo on the screen.
Trying to reach out and grab as many younger viewers as they can and show that they understand the Internet.
They'd rather tie their fortunes to a growing demographic than an aging one. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Today's corporate giant you might never have heard of goes by the name BHP Billiton. It's the biggest mining company in the world, and it wants to get bigger. Today, the Australian firm sweetened its offer to buy a big rival and at the same time get control of more than a third of the world's iron ore production. That rival, Rio Tinto, rejected the bid out of hand, said $147 billion still isn't enough. Rio's a British and Australian joint venture, but Marketplace's Bob Moon reports that it's China that's the real force behind the deal.
The Chinese have an iron will to fend off this merger. Their steel industry is the world's biggest, four times bigger than the U.S., and growing. In fact, we get much of our steel from China. But the Chinese need the ore to make that steel, and they aren't alone in fearing a new mining colossus could drive ore prices higher. BHP argues combining the companies would save billions by getting rid of overlapping operations, bringing more ore to the market faster and cheaper. But Frederick Gitz of the Fitch Ratings Agency says BHP isn't waging this battle with altruistic intentions.
With this market pricing power, it's unlikely that the ultimate buyers of their product would benefit. They are not going to pass it through to their end customer just for the pleasure of passing it through.
Even if shareholders approve, the merger would need to clear regulators in Australia, Britain, the U.S., Japan, and Korea. And amid tight credit, it'll be tough to find investors for the biggest bank loan in history, $55 billion to help fund the deal. That amounts to the gross domestic product of New Zealand. The Chinese aren't sitting idly by either. The state-run Aluminum Corporation of China, Chinalco, just joined forces with America's Alcoa Corporation to quietly grab up a 10% stake in Rio Tinto. Mike Komisaroff is an industry consultant. He says that could complicate BHP's takeover plans.
I've got to take my hat off to Chinalco. It was a perfectly executed transaction. This was a high-profile set of shares that they acquired under the noses of the world without people realizing it.
It sets the stage for a clash of the titans that could take months to play out. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Today, the Bush administration announced the most significant overhaul of the agricultural guest worker program in about 20 years. The general idea is to make it easier and faster for farms to hire workers from other countries. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has that story.
U.S. farms rely on undocumented labor. More than half of the 1.2 million farm workers in the U.S. are here illegally. But with a crackdown on illegal immigration, farms are left without workers and crops are rotting in the field. Today, the Bush administration submitted a 186-page plan it says will streamline the foreign guest farm worker system. Bruce Goldstein directs Farm Worker Justice, an advocacy group. He says the proposed overhaul of the H-2A visa system is essentially a handout to agribusiness.
The proposal would slash the wage rates of U.S. workers and guest workers, eliminate housing requirements, reduce government oversight, and in other ways would harm farm workers unnecessarily.
The National Council of Agricultural Employers says it welcomes improvements on the, quote, inefficient and unaffordable H-2A program. But Council President Michael Gempler says for the overhaul to work, bureaucrats will need to operate on a farm's timetable.
If you have cherries that are highly perishable and need to be harvested, you can't wait while the government shuffles the papers around.
Critics of the Bush plan say a better solution is already available. A bill in Congress called Ag Jobs would create a new guest worker program that would allow laborers to eventually become citizens. But the bill is stalled in the Senate as the war over illegal immigration rages on. The public can comment on the Bush administration's proposed changes over the next 45 days. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
There's a new chapter in the Southeast water wars, and it's raising questions about whether or not Atlanta can keep growing during a record drought. Georgia, Alabama, and Florida have been suing each other over water for 18 years. Yesterday, an appeals court said Atlanta doesn't have any legal rights to the water from Lake Lanier, that's a federal reservoir outside the city, because its waters flow to the downstream states as well. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports.
Some of Atlanta's critics say this court decision means the city should stop issuing new building permits until it can prove it has a long-term water supply.
It might happen, but pigs would probably fly first.
That's George William Shirk, a water law expert at the Colorado School of Mines. He says Georgia could ask Congress to change the law and give it rights to Lake Lanier's water, but that's also about as likely as a flying pig. Shirk says the uncertainty caused by yesterday's ruling could scare developers away from Atlanta. Those who keep building houses might face new water fees.
we're looking at hookup costs that can easily run 10% of the price of a house.
Atlanta officials insist there's plenty of water to go around. Chick Krautler heads the Atlanta Regional Commission, which is in charge of water use.
The issue is how much water is available for our downstream neighbors. How do we share the water supply that's available?
The governors of Georgia, Alabama, and Florida are supposed to come up with a water sharing plan by February 15th. Georgia says it's committed to that process, but it's keeping its legal options open. It may appeal yesterday's decision to the Supreme Court. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Strong profits from some big-name companies couldn't turn the tide of inflation fears on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So you're walking down the street, your cell phone buzzes. No, it's not a call, it's an ad, maybe a dollar off a latte. And lo and behold, there's a coffee shop right there. It's kind of like they knew where you were. Well, they do, of course. GPS tells cell phone companies your whereabouts. That's old hat. But today, CBS Mobile announced a way for advertisers to sell into that cell phone market. To find out exactly how, we called Alice Cuneo of Ad Age magazine.
Well, CBS Mobile has hooked up with a relatively small mobile service called Looped. And Looped, it's for the young people and other people who wanted to know where their friends were. So like if they had gone out and they wanted to, you know, catch up with their friends, they could opt into this Looped service. And using GPS technology, they could tell you that your friends were down the block or around the corner.
This is such an attractive option for advertisers. They must be just salivating at the prospect of all those cell phones out there as potential targets for very specifically targeted ads.
Yes, they absolutely are. And, you know, this is to them the killer app to be able to reach people when they're about to put their hand in their pocket to spend money on something, to ping people as they walk by or as they were shopping. If you're shopping for a Canon printer, they would like to be able to tell you that the HP printer is on sale down the block.
Okay, but here's the thing. I don't want to be pinged about an HP printer. I just want to go on about my business and make the calls I want and take the calls I want.
Well, that's one of the problems of this, you know, this opportunity for marketers. And one of the reasons they need to operate very gingerly. People do not want to be pinged when they're in church, you know, on an ad, you know, for a Viagra medicine. And most reputable marketers will use an opt-in technology. So in other words, you would have to say it's okay to ping me.
What advertisers might be interested in this service? Would it be some of the bigger chains, like, say, Starbucks, just to keep picking on them? Or would it be the local hardware store having a special on, you know, hammers?
It could be anyone. It could be the local bar that's having a slow night that would want to, you know, send out a message to come in and get, you know, half off a martini or something. And some of the marketers are willing to pay good bucks for this kind of technology. For example, if you were walking down the street and they pinged you and you actually went into the store, they would get a finder's fee, a very lucrative finder's fee, which is much higher than some of the fees that are paid to marketers, you know, for marketing on even the Super Bowl.
Is this a little bit like that famous saying about privacy in the technology age? You don't have any privacy, so get over it?
I think that there's a possibility of that. Yesterday, I saw a TV clip where they were throwing a shark back into the ocean from the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and he was like all fitted out with little tracking devices. That's like going to be us, you know, fish in the sea with little tracking devices on us.
Alice Cuneo is the West Coast editor for Ad Age magazine. Alice, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The heck with gold. Platinum was the truly precious metal today. It tipped the scales at a record $1,819 an ounce. Demand is up, so that's part of it. Also, a power crisis in South Africa has forced mines to cut back on their operations. About two-thirds of the world's supply of platinum is mined in the northwest parts of South Africa, but precious little of those profits reach the local economy. Gretchen Wilson reports now on one community that's trying to make sure more of those profits do trickle down.
I'm standing on the richest known reserve of platinum in the world. Chutes spit rubble onto huge pyramids of black rock. Just beyond, runoff water pours into a slime pit. Behind me is the sprawling slum of Mafadikwe, flimsy tin shacks with no electricity or running water. Poverty and HIV are widespread. 52-year-old mine worker Silas Putswane says most people come here with just one hope.
They can come and work and get some money to feed themselves and to feed their children.
Putswane started this brass band to help his jobless neighbors. The unemployment rate here stands at 60%. Bands like Putswane's play at weddings and funerals for money. About 500,000 black South Africans live here in the homeland of the Royal Bafokeng Nation. Conditions are bleak, but this is actually the vanguard of community-oriented mining. For centuries, the Bafokeng resisted colonization and held on to their land. Now the Royal Bafokeng Nation is a shareholder in mines owned by the world's largest platinum producers. Sue Cook is an anthropologist who works with the Bafokeng. She says this is in stark contrast to mining industries in Zambia, Sudan, and other parts of Africa that allow mining companies full ownership and demand little back for their local people.
The leading edge of globalization with regard to extractive industries is to come in with your own equipment, your own people, your own security force, your own technology. Take what you need and leave very little behind.
The Bafokeng Nation has earned hundreds of millions of dollars in the last decade and stands to earn about $200 million a year here on out. Meanwhile, Bafokeng and migrant workers earn meager wages, but more than other mineral miners in the region, and will until the minerals run out in about 40 years. And by then, Pokeng should look very different.
I think you are likely to see a thriving metropolitan area with a range of industries operating from there, where I think basic infrastructure such as education and health and so on will be of, if not absolute world-class standard, pretty close to that.
That's Niall Carroll, CEO of Royal Bafokeng Holdings, an investment firm that handles the community's money. And taking a hint from the Middle East, they're diversifying their investments away from their diminishing asset and into technology, freight services, and agriculture.
There's the same vision, and there's the same long-term view to say, how do you take an area of the world and create an enabling environment to attract investment?
Pokeng is teeming with construction crews, building health clinics, world-class sports stadiums, and 1,000 miles of new roads. Kumo Makhano is with the Royal Bafokeng Nation.
We have managed as an indigenous community to achieve all of those things because of what we are reaping from the mines themselves.
The Royal Bafokeng Nation is upgrading this area's 80 schools. Part of the plan is a $64 million flagship school in Pokeng that's already drawn the best teachers in the country. Gladys Muljwane is a second grade teacher in a new bilingual classroom.
We're looking at something that we've never seen before. We can see that the vision of the school is going to be achieved. And what is going to be then will be something that will be the model for South Africa, maybe the whole world.
Right now, platinum money is putting 800 local students through college in South Africa's biggest cities. The idea is to develop them into engineers, doctors, and teachers who will return to the Royal Bafokeng Nation. In Pokeng, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Coming up, companies push for bigger returns on your retirement.
We want to have the very best plans with the top quality service for our 401k participants.
Service that doesn't come cheap. But first, let's do the numbers. Fears that inflation could prevent future interest rate cuts pushed stocks lower today. The Dow Industrials gave back 0.5%, 65 points. closed at 12,200. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq flopped 1.3%, 30 points, closed at 2278. The S&P 500 moved down 0.75%, 10 points, ended the day at 1326. Hannah Montana, High School Musical, and ESPN helped the Walt Disney Company beat analysts' first quarter expectations. The House O' Mouse picked up 4.75%. We told you about Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton. Investors punished both companies. They grounded BHP shares by almost 5%. Rio Tinto lost nearly 3%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.6%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for December. A House committee holds a hearing on military quality of life. And on February 7, 1964, fans screamed their guts out at Kennedy Airport when the Beatles landed, about to embark on their first U.S. tour. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Senate of the United States is still trying to figure out what it thinks about the economic stimulus package. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson told the Budget Committee today he'd just as soon they vote on the cheaper House version and be done with it. Specifically, he said the White House doesn't see any need to extend unemployment benefits. Commentator Robert Reich does, but he says the whole unemployment insurance system needs to be fixed.
The Senate is considering whether to lengthen the period of time people can collect unemployment benefits if they still can't find a job after 6 months, which is how long unemployment insurance is now available. Now, that's sensible. A new study by the Economic Policy Institute estimates that almost 2 million job losers will run out of unemployment benefits this year unless benefits are extended. It's not unusual to extend benefits during a recession because recessions often last longer than 6 months and businesses don't start hiring again until the economy picks up. And there are few better ways to stimulate the economy. Unemployment benefits put cash directly in the hands of people who need it most and are most likely to spend it. But running out of benefits isn't the biggest problem facing job losers. It's getting benefits to begin with. The troubling fact is most people who lose their jobs simply don't qualify. That's because the unemployment insurance system was designed more than a half century ago. Back then, most people who lost their jobs had been fully employed full-time for years, and most households had one wage earner. Even though these realities have changed, the rules haven't. In most states, you're eligible for unemployment insurance only if you've lost a full-time job that you've had for quite a while. This leaves out just about everyone who's lost one or more part-time jobs, and also excludes any full-time worker who had been at the job less than a year before they got canned. It also excludes people who had to leave their job to accompany a working spouse to another city or state. Altogether, the current rules leave out more than half of the American workforce. So it's not enough merely to extend unemployment benefits. If Congress really wants to help the millions of Americans who will lose their jobs in the coming recession and also stimulate the economy, it should make sure job losers get benefits in the first place.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Back in the day, he was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. Your comments are always welcome. Go to marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. Responsible investment advisors are probably all telling their clients the same thing right about now. Forget what the stock market's doing today. Focus on the long haul. But come on. admit it. Last time you opened a quarterly statement from your 401k, you did a double take when you saw how much money you'd lost, right? Little did you know that even in good times, you could be losing thousands of dollars thanks to the fees tucked inside most retirement plans. Tess Vigeland hosts our weekend personal finance program, Marketplace Money. She's got the first of a two-part report on those fees and the damage they can do to your golden years.
The employees of St. Paul Shipwrights, a yacht restoration company in Minnesota, are hoping to stash away a bigger chunk of their salaries toward retirement. So office manager Rebecca Peterson decided to look into 401k plans. She started by meeting with a representative of a local bank that also serves as a 401k management company.
You know, she started laying out the fees, and you know, you're looking at a, like a $1,400 startup fee. And then it said $75 per participant. In parentheses, it says, but there's a $3,000 minimum record-keeping fee. You know, already we're looking at, you know, $300 per person to run this plan.
The list of fees went on and on. Most 401k participants know they're paying for somebody to manage their plan, but many have no idea just how many fingers are in that pot. There's the sub-transfer agent fee, the 12b-1 fee, early redemption fee, custodial fee, wrap fee, investment advisor fee, attorney and actuary fees. And those fees are charged even if your 401k is losing money. Pension consultant Matthew Hutchison says many of them are nowhere to be found on your quarterly statement.
Well, most participants think that they're paying $20 per year contract charge, for example. But what they haven't told you is that the underlying fund managers, those who are actually managing the investments, they charge a fee.
Hutchison calculates up to 14 different individuals or companies could be taking a piece of your retirement fund, and it all adds up to big money.
Over a 20, 25-year period, if you are being charged a total of 1% in your retirement account, the ultimate benefits that you'll receive when you retire, let's say age 65, will be reduced by approximately 20%.
And Hutchison points out that the average 401k plan charges slightly more than 3%.
Over a regular working lifetime of a regular person, we're talking about $80,000.
Those kinds of numbers caught the attention of Congress. It's held several hearings into 401k fees and the fact that nobody can really figure out how much they're being charged. One main target is something called revenue-sharing commissions. Employers often hire third parties to help them choose a mutual fund company for a 401k plan. Sometimes the mutual fund company then pays commissions to that third party with money from your 401k account.
The key here is that you want service and performance before you get concerned with fees.
David Ray is president of the Profit-Sharing 401k Council of America.
There are a lot of legal issues involved in managing a plan. There are compliance issues with the government. We want to have the very best plans with the top quality service for our 401k participants.
And Ray argues that employees in 401k plans are actually getting a good deal.
If you're at a large company, and probably two-thirds of 401k participants are in a large company, the fees are probably about one-fifth of what they would be if you were actually investing on your own as a retail investor.
Ray also points out that by law, employers have to make sure fees are, quote, reasonable. What's reasonable? There is no standard definition, all of which puts office manager Rebecca Peterson in a bind.
Actually, you know, kind of makes me want to throw up my hands and just invest in pork bellies.
Instead, she'll spend the next several months trying to strip the fat from her company's 401k plan. In Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, a federal grand jury has indicted three companies for importing ingredients that might have led to the deaths of thousands of pets last year. News of contaminated pet food additives from China sparked worries about other imports from that country, leaded toys for one. The companies indicted today, two in China, one of them in Las Vegas, Nevada, are charged with mislabeling 800 metric tons of wheat gluten that was tainted with a toxic chemical called melamine. That gluten eventually found its way into the pet food supply chain. And that is a melamine-free marketplace for today from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 65 points, half of 1%. The NASDAQ dumped 30 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 fell 10 points. That's about 0.75% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, crunching the numbers on those 401k fees can turn you into a wreck.
It's like a person who buys a car. They want to know what the price of the car is. They don't want to know what the price of the engine is, what the price of the front door handle is. What they want to know is what's the total cost.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.